Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. After the death of Osama bin Laden, Boston crime boss James Whitey Bulger rose to the top of the FBI's 10 most wanted list. He grew from a 1940s juvenile delinquent to a sociopathic killer in the 1960s to unbeatable and FBI-enabled crime boss in the 1980s to fugitive from justice in 1995. 16 years later, at age 81, Bulger was tracked down and arrested, and 2 years after that, went to trial. He was sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms in prison for 11 murders. The story of his life of crime is the subject of the major motion picture Black Mass, starring Johnny Depp. The movie is based on the book Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and a Devil's Deal by then Boston Globe reporters Dick Glare and Gerard O'Neill. Joining us now is former Boston Globe reporter and co-author of the book Black Mass, Dick Glare. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Ann. Good to be with you.
You also are co-author of the sequel to your first book. It's entitled Whitey, The Life of America's Most Notorious Mob Boss. 2 books about one guy's life, that's a lot, and there are many more by others. What makes him so storylicious, I guess?
Yeah, no, I think there are 2 key parts to that answer, and the first is Whitey Bulger himself, who's a hands-on, cold-blooded killer, and who has survived in a profession with a short shelf life. I mean, he's one of the most violent crime bosses in American history. The second key to this is that he's done something that he did something no other crime boss or famous American gangster can ever claim. He became an informant for the FBI in the mid-1970s, but quickly turned the tables, and he corrupted and compromised a band of FBI agents who, in effect, became part of his gang. And what gangster wouldn't want to have the nation's top law enforcement agency watching their back? And that's what puts, I think, Whitey Bulger at the front of the line in the annals of American gangsterhood.
When did he pop up on your radar screen as a journalist?
Well, I was part of a team of reporters in the late 1980s that was doing an in-depth narrative biography of Whitey Bulger and his younger brother, Bill, who in the late 1980s was president of the Massachusetts State Senate and arguably the most powerful pal in Massachusetts. So it was a tale of 2 brothers, both at the top of their respective games. And no one had ever really just assembled that fascinating story. And they grew up in the same bedroom in a housing project in Boston. And in the course of that reporting, on the Whitey side of things, is we began to scratch away and come up with an answer on why he had this Houdini-like ability to always elude law enforcement. And that was the fact that he had a special relationship with the Boston office of the FBI. It was an explosive and revelation around these parts at the time.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. The film Black Mass opens this weekend across the country. It is about the notorious Boston crime boss and murderer, James Whitey Bulger. My guest is the longtime former Boston Globe reporter and co-author of the book Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and a Devil's Deal. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Why was he called Whitey? Was it just a looks thing?
It was in the beginning. I mean, he was a teenage hellion in his South Boston neighborhood, and he had this platinum blonde hair that got him the nickname Whitey. Interestingly, it's a nickname he always hated. If you were around him and you were his friend, you called him Jim or Jimmy. So much so that the FBI agent who was his handler, and this is where it goes into, the heart of darkness, mm-hmm. Was an agent by the name of John Conley, and he also had grown up in South Boston, 10 years younger than Whitey, and was in awe then of this Bulger family. He became, in the mid-70s, the guy who was able to turn Whitey into an informant, and he would tell anybody, any of the other agents in the office, don't ever call him Whitey. He hates that. Call him Jimmy. And I think that's just a small one of many indications that who was in charge.
It is fascinating. It's the stuff of sort of fiction that his brother became so prominent in politics. Pretty squeaky clean in his own way, I guess, for, you know, Massachusetts politician, I guess. But
well, that's open to debate.
Right, exactly. It's open to debate. But how did they grow up to be such different personas?
I think a lot of it had to do with that, you know, Whitey, there are six kids in the family. Whitey was the oldest son. And when they moved into South Boston, he was already a troublemaker. And he had, their father was a much older. He could have been their grandfather. I mean, he had the marriage later in life and the kids and whatnot. He was remote, and Whitey later wrote, and it was established, you know, they had a terrible relationship as took to the streets at an early age. And I think two things. Whitey found a nourishment and a nurturing on the streets. Like, here I am, somebody. I don't get any love at home, but I get love on the streets. It's pretty perverse, but I think that's part of the psychology of Whitey. And he shielded, I think, his younger brother, Bill, from that fatherly abuse that was going on at home. And the younger brother, when they moved to South Boston, was also at an age when he could be steered by his mother into the local parish church and into the Catholic school. And he was dutiful and studious. And I think some of those, the age difference and some of the timing of things are part of the explanation by why Whitey was already on the streets, and that was his path. And the younger brother, Bill, went through the system, so to speak.
Your book, in some ways, is as much about the FBI, well, the Boston office of the FBI, as it is about Whitey Bulger in many ways. Tell us about how it started that they tried to get him on their side and how he turned it around.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right to say that the FBI is like a major character in the story. And as a journalist, it was, I have to say, the main focus at the time, because they're the public agency. You know, journalism is, in the watchdog role in a democracy. What was astounding to us was the FBI corruption and exploring that and trying to document that and explain and understand how the heck that happened. And a lot of it boils, if you drill down, it boils down to relationships. The fact that John Connolly, the agent in the lead here, was a son of South Boston, who already had grown up in awe of the Bulgers, and Whitey was much older. From the get-go, there was almost it was doomed to fail in terms of the power dynamic and Whitey's ability to manipulate and turn the tables. The whole thing got underway in terms of the FBI. Why John Connolly even had a green light to do this is because in the 1970s, the FBI had a formal program called the Top Echelon Informant Program, where agents were encouraged to find rats in the underworld who can help us with, at that time, the Bureau's number one organized crime priority, which was La Cosa Nostra. So all of this was sort of rationalized and justified under that, policy mandate to get the Italian mafia.
He never turned out to be that great of a snitch on anything, right?
I know. That was the stunning thing. I mean, not only was Whitey in charge, but one of the things, when we really were able to get all the documents over the years and analyze things that we found Connolly cooked the books to embellish Whitey's contributions. I mean, there's no question he was an informant, but mm-hmm. he wasn't a very good one. And not that even if he was, God's gift to underworld informing, it would never justify I think the murders and the wrongdoing and the crime that were committed over nearly two decades while he was on FBI time.
The murders that he was accused of killing 19 people, he was convicted of killing 11.
Yep.
Why did he kill people in general? I mean, was he just a sociopath that just killed without remorse just to get somebody out of the way? Or what was his typical motivation?
There almost always was a business purpose to it.
Uh-huh.
But what also kind of distinguishes him is that a lot of crime bosses assign someone else to be, the hatchet man. Whitey was a hands-on, cold-blooded killer. I think he was a psychopath. But again, from the reporting and from which emerged from all those around him, I think he got some pleasure at times in some of his killings, particularly those he had caught informing against him. He seemed to have a special satisfaction in eliminating that kind of person. So I think that's a big part of it.
He was called a pedophile as well. He had a relationship or sex or raped a girl from high school, and ended up killing her too. What happened with that?
You know, that was never. I think you might be mixing up a couple of things.
Okay.
I know there's been a lot of rumors about, you know, he was a homosexual, a pedophile. Those are the kinds of and that's been written in some of the books. I haven't seen enough to I mean, they're not in our books. They haven't been established in terms of verified and to our satisfaction. And there is a tendency here in Boston to, at the end, because the guy's so heinous and so, you know, such a monster, to almost blame every crime and unsolved homicide on Whitey Bulger. There's that, and frankly, it doesn't surprise me. But there are certain things that haven't been verified, I think, to most journalists' satisfaction.
The house there's a house that three bodies were found in the basement.
Yes,
buried in the basement. One of them was a girl.
Yes, and that was Deborah Hussey, mm-hmm. and he did strangle her, and that's actually one of the murders that is dramatized in the film. And the reason why she had to go is because Bulger had a partner named Stevie Flemmy, his sort of co-gang leader, and Flemmy had a relationship with this young woman who was a drug addict and a prostitute, and Flemmy admitted that he may have said too much to her about their activities. So Whitey's solution to most problems when he feels like there might be a security vulnerability is to eliminate the problem. So he strangled young Deborah Hussey in a house in South Boston where two other murders had already been committed, and the idea of getting rid of the bodies was there was a soft basement in that house where it was mostly dirt. It wasn't a concrete basement. Mm-hmm. So they were digging up holes and just throwing the corpses on top of each other.
Have you seen the movie?
I did. The Boston premiere was two nights ago.
What'd you think?
It blew me away. You know, it's a movie. These are events that the epic saga of Whitey and the FBI played out over several decades. A movie's 2 hours, so there's certainly a lot of, it has to be different in terms of compressing and, characters and action and all that. But I think Johnny Depp inhabits Whitey Bulger in a bone-chilling way. And all the acting was really powerful. To the director's credit, he did not blink or shy away from the horror and the darkness that is at the heart of this story. They didn't try to glamorize or buff up or sugarcoat this drama.
Did you ever meet Whitey Bulger?
Never met him. Well, tried to as a reporter, especially after his capture, and we were working on the biography you mentioned. You know, wrote him a bunch of times in prison, and his lawyer came up in court to me one day and said, you know, he's just never going to talk to you. He's never done an interview or faced any questions from someone who knows anything about the story. He has written people from prison, but it's usually the people who don't know anything, and he's just channeling and wants to get out whatever commentary he wants to get out.
Well, I want to thank you so much, Dick Lehrer, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Dick Lehrer is a former Boston Globe reporter and co-author of the book Black Mass, Whitey Bulger, the FBI, and a Devil's Deal. The book Black Mass that opens this week, starring Johnny Depp, is based on the book co-authored by Dick Lehrer. More on the Whitey Bulger story coming up. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the life of notorious Boston crime boss James Whitey Bulger and how he was able to stay out of the hands of the law for so long. A big reason had to do with his secret relationship as an informant for the FBI. Here's what David Boeri, senior reporter at WBUR in Boston, had to say about Bulger after his capture in 2011.
It was the evil genius of Bulger who became a federal informant, a secret top echelon federal informant, and then turned the tentacles on the FBI so that it became, as he loved to say, the Bulger Bureau of Investigations.
Joining us now by phone is the author of a new book about Bulger's impact. It's entitled Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger and the World That Made Him, T.J. English. Welcome to the show, T.J.
Thanks for having me.
Right off the bat in your book, I sense the story is more about the people Bulger hurt or murdered. It starts with a conversation you had with a man named Joe Silvati. Very interesting. Tell us about him.
Joe Silvati was an average Joe citizen who got roped into one of the worst travesties of justice in recent history in the United States. In the late 1960s, he was fingered and convicted for a murder that he didn't commit by a notorious mafia informant named Joe Barboza. Joe Barboza was sort of a precursor to Whitey Bulger. The FBI forged a relationship with him as an informant and got him to take the stand in a number of mafia trials and other trials. And one of them was the trial of a low-level gangster named Teddy Deegan. Barboza had been involved in that murder himself. He took the stand and fingered four innocent men and was enabled in doing that by his FBI handlers. They knew he was doing it. They authorized his doing it. They helped him with his false testimony. And his doing that was approved and authorized all the way up the chain of command to Director J. Edgar Hoover. Now, none of this was known at the time, of course. Silvati was convicted and he was given a life sentence, as were three other men, two of whom died while in prison during this long period before it was finally revealed in the late 1990s that they had been framed. And ironically, it was when Bulger went on the run in 96 and his underlings got left behind and many of them cut deals with the government. One of them, his partner, Steve Flemmi, who had also been an informant for the FBI, came forward and started to tell tales from Boston gangland lore going back 40 years. And one of them was this great travesty of justice that had taken place. Joe Silvati got out of prison after serving 30 years for this crime. So I consider that framing of innocent men and the role that the criminal justice system played in enabling it is sort of the original sin of what would later become the Whitey Bulger era.
Because once they were willing to ruin the lives of four innocent people, they would do anything.
Yes, exactly. And not only that, the relationship they created with Barboza that made all that possible became sort of the template that they used in forging relationships with other gangsters, including Bulger, in the years that followed.
What changed about the FBI that took it on this trajectory?
You know, I don't know if we would call it a change. It might just be a continuation of policy. J. Edgar Hoover had been embarrassed in the early 1960s. J. Edgar Hoover had sort of denied that the mafia existed in the United States for a long time. And in 1963, Attorney General Bobby Kennedy put a mafiosi named Joe Valachi on a witness stand and had him give testimony live on television about the inner workings of the mafia. And it was absolutely riveting. It was a public sensation. And it put the whole concept of this exotic criminal culture, the mafia, front and center in the public consciousness. Well, Hoover now had some catching up to do because he had been denying the existence of the mafia. So he quickly instituted a policy called the Top Echelon Informant Program, and it was designed for agents to go out into the field and find and recruit criminals who are active criminals within the criminal underworld and cultivate them as informants, sign them up as informants, pay them in many cases, and use them to take the organization down from within and make cases against organized crime. And this became the highest mandate of the FBI at that time. Hoover sent out a memo to everyone about this policy, making it clear that this was going to be the highest priority of the FBI moving forward. And it really kicked off an era of by any means necessary in terms of the way that agents went about cultivating informants, protecting informants, engaging in a whole area of sort of a dark and a gray area. These relationships were left in kind of a gray area. There wasn't a lot of accountability, not a lot of supervision. And you wound up having disasters like the Whitey Bulger fiasco.
It's interesting that the guy from the FBI who made him the informant was a Southie himself, from South Boston himself. So he had an emotional relationship with the myth or the world of Whitey Bulger.
Yeah. Yes, that's true. But it's also true that John Connolly was his name, and he was from South Boston. He was recruited from within the FBI as the guy who could potentially get them Whitey Bulger. They had been trying to get Bulger as an informant since the early 1970s. And some of the same agents who had been the handlers of Barboza were involved in forging the relationship with Bulger. It was sort of a passing of the baton from the Barboza era to the Bulger era. And they were having trouble gaining Whitey's trust. John Connolly at that time was assigned to New York City, and the agents wanted to get Connolly back to Boston. And so they deliberately staged an arrest. They had inside information about a Boston gangster who was on the street in New York. And they passed this information on to Connolly, and they sort of arranged for Connolly to make a sensational street arrest of this Boston gangster in Manhattan. And as a reward for that, Connolly was able to choose whatever posting he wanted, and he chose Boston. He came back to his hometown. One of his first tasks was to reach out to Bulger and forge this relationship with Bulger. But Connolly was not the orchestrator of that. It was really orchestrated from within the FBI by this culture of agents who was making great headway in their own careers by getting informants, making cases based on informants, and the cultivating of Bulger as an informant was all part of this process.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about the world of Whitey Bulger and the FBI that helped shape that world. My guest is T.J. English. He's the author of a new book. It's called Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger and the World That Made Him. You use the phrase culture of agents. They sort of became sort of superstars in the FBI. They got perks and bonuses and things like that, right?
Yeah, because the top echelon informant program was such a high priority of Hoover's, that anyone that facilitated this program was going to be highly rewarded within the system. You would be economically rewarded, but more importantly, you'd be rewarded by stature and esteem within the law enforcement culture. And that can't really be underestimated because, you know, in movies, generally, when we see corrupt law enforcement, you know, they're getting suitcases full of money under the table, or they're getting drugs, or they're getting some high level of payoff for it. When in fact, corruption in law enforcement is often smaller and more petty than that, and really has to do with career advancement and ego gratification within the culture that you're operating. So John Connolly, for instance, Bulger's handler, he takes over the handling of Bulger, and he becomes the most highly esteemed agent in Boston. I mean, he becomes a superstar within the FBI and really within all of law enforcement. in the jurisdiction of New England, because it's sort of known, although it's not supposed to be known, who your informants are. It's known to almost everybody that Connally has this special informant, and it's Whitey Bulger, and Whitey Bulger can't be touched because of his relationship with Connally and the FBI.
Not
the
only
FBI protected him.
Right. They protected him against prosecution of heinous crimes.
Yeah, I know. It's shocking. I mean, I've been following this story and writing about it for more than a decade now, and it still blows my mind. Yeah, they would sabotage investigations by other agencies, the state police, the DEA, in the interest of protecting Bulger and Flemmy, keeping them out on the street, ostensibly to make cases against the mafia. And as they were doing that, Bulger and Flemmy were sort of getting away with all kinds of criminal activity, and I think developing delusions of grandeur because they're committing crimes all these years and they're getting away with it. And I think they had come to the conclusion that they were like God in the criminal underworld, that they could get away with anything. And their crimes started to become more and more depraved. There was always murders involved in gangsterism and the criminal underworld, but eventually the murders weren't even so much about business anymore. You had Bulger and Flemmy murdering Flemmy's ex-girlfriend, murdering his stepdaughter, strangling these women to death with their bare hands, really depraved criminal acts, all done under the auspices of the federal government.
When did the FBI begin to chafe?
Well, there was a few places along the way that the FBI should have been called on the carpet and made to chafe. There was a particular period in the 1980s when the Bulger organization committed four murders within a period of about 18 months. And these murders involved a couple legitimate businessmen who weren't gangsters at all, one in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and one in Miami, Florida. And it was brought to the attention of the Justice Department that these murders were taking place and that two men who were informants, Bulger and Flemmy, possibly were involved in these crimes. So they had a major summit meeting down in Washington, D.C., high officials of the Justice Department, the FBI, the U.S. Attorney's Office from the District of Massachusetts. They should have been concerned about the fact that their informants were potentially out there murdering people. But what they were concerned about was, how do we protect our assets? And this was one of the great horrors of the Bulger story, that at a certain point along the way, certain points when it was called to the attention of the bureaucracy of what was happening, their instinct was to cover it up and protect their informants. And I think that the motivation behind that was to go back to the Barbosa era and this horrible travesty of justice that had been done with the complicity of the FBI, that the fear that that would ever be revealed, that that could come out, that if Bulger and Flemmy were revealed to be informants, that that would come out, which is eventually what did happen. But the fear of that was so strong that the bureaucracy rallied around an instinct of self-preservation and self-protection rather than transparency.
And here's the thing. Whitey Bulger never really told them anything particularly special.
Yeah, that's a comical part of this whole thing. Connally and his supervisor, a guy named John Morris, who was also very much in on this, they puffed up Whitey's informant file. They added a lot of information in there they didn't get from Whitey, that they were stealing from other files in the FBI office. They were raiding other informant files, stealing information, putting it in Whitey's file to try to enhance his reputation. And it worked. Within the law enforcement structure, the idea that Whitey was somehow this really valuable informant became legend almost. And Whitey's reputation within the FBI and law enforcement hierarchy, Whitey became untouchable. also.
Why did they do that? If he wasn't that valuable to them, they did it because he got something on them.
Yeah, I think I tend to think it all goes back to this, to the original sin that, you know, people, a lot of people within the system knew that that framing of innocent people had taken place. It was sort of the dirty little secret that a lot of people knew about. There were rumors about it. It had been alluded to in books and in reporting. And so the system was afraid that this would be revealed. And there was, you know, a very strong mandate to keep this history buried. And I just think that I think that the relationship with Flemmi and Bulger became an extension of that, that when you entered into, when the criminals and the lawmen entered into this pact, part of this pact was to become the custodians of this dirty history and to make sure that it was never revealed. And that somehow got intertwined and twisted up with their role as informants, and that the idea that they were providing information that was helping them make cases against the mafia, which was a fiction that they created. So I came to the conclusion it had to be larger than that. And what was larger than that was basically protecting and preserving the reputation of the criminal justice system, because if that travesty of justice ever became known, it could destroy the credibility of the entire system.
And what finally forced law enforcement to put him on the run?
Well, the DEA had begun to make a case separate from the FBI, and this was by the time of the 90s, and Bulger's FBI handler had retired, and he wasn't quite protected as much. In fact, I think he had been closed as a top echelon informant by then, so he no longer had the relationship with the FBI, mm-hmm. and now he was vulnerable, and the DEA was making a case against him. And John Connolly, who had gone into retirement by then but still had contacts in the FBI, heard that the case was going to go down and that Bulger was going to be arrested, and he leaked this information to Bulger, and Bulger was able to go on the run before he was arrested.
We're talking about the life and crimes of James Whitey Bulger, the notorious Boston crime boss. My guest is T.J. Inglis. He's English. He's the author of a new book on the topic. It's entitled Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger and the World That Made Him. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Thomas Baxter, Mark Shapton, Charles Gasco. These are just a few of the aliases that Boston crime boss James Whitey Bulger used to elude capture for nearly 16 years, until 2011.
Notorious mob boss returned to Massachusetts today to face charges in connection with 19 murders. Bulger just appeared in federal court moments ago, where his brother, former Senate President William Bulger, was waiting for him. Tonight, we've also learned that his girlfriend, Catherine Gregg, is going to be held at a Rhode Island detention facility.
Bulger is now serving two life sentences in a penitentiary in Florida. Still with us is the author of a new book entitled Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger and the World That Made Him. T.J. Inglis, once again, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You there's a house that you write about early on in the book, a relatively nondescript house in its way, but it had a dirt-floored basement.
Yes, yes. This is kind of the dark core of the Bulger story. It was a house of a Bulger associate by the name of Pat Nee. His brother owned the house. And Whitey had come up with the idea of using this house when the brother was out of town. They would use the house as a place of entrapment, murder, and body disposal. They would lure people to the house under false context, usually criminal associates that they were doing business with of one kind or another, lure them to this house, torture them, get information out of them, try to get money out of them, and then take them down in the basement and murder them and bury the bodies in the basement. And they did three murders over the course of about 2 years at that house, buried the bodies in the basement there. And then the brother was going to sell the house, and they knew they had to get the bodies out of there. And so I had a source, Pat Nee, who told me a lot of the details of this. And the bodies were dug up. They had to dig the bodies up in the basement. It was a grisly task, partly decomposed bodies, and take them to another location and bury them so that they wouldn't be detected. And it's always shocked me because this house is sort of a placid little house in the middle of, on a nice street in a nice neighborhood of South Boston. And the intimacy of it, the fact that these three guys who all were sort of knew each other from the neighborhood, and the burying bodies in the house of one of the brothers of one of the guys, and they dug the bodies up. It was Halloween, by the way, the night that they dug the bodies up and removed them to another location. Just very ghoulish and disturbing, but typical of the level of violence and depravity that was happening in the years of Whitey Bulger.
What was the reputation of Whitey Bulger in the larger community outside of the crime, outside of South Boston? How many people knew about what he was doing, or had an inkling, or had a sense about that there was this guy out there amassing a great fortune and very, very dangerously?
Yeah, it emerged in the public eye very slowly over a long period of time. Initially, Whitey Bulger was a rising gangster in the city, and he wasn't that well, never been written about in the papers or in the press. He wasn't that known. He was known in South Boston primarily because of his brother, who was Senator William Bulger, who was the most powerful politician in the state of Massachusetts, eventually rose to being president of the Massachusetts State Senate. And his career as a politician was in ascendancy at the same time Whitey Bulger's was as a gangster in the underworld. And so people knew of Whitey in Southie as the brother of this powerful politician, and they accepted it because Whitey was also building a mythology about himself as a protector of the neighborhood, as a guy who was a benevolent gangster. Yeah, he was a criminal, he was a gangster, but he was our gangster. People didn't know the full dimensions of what he was doing. They didn't know that he was the biggest cocaine supplier in the neighborhood and probably in the whole city of Boston. Whitey spread the myth that he didn't touch narcotics, that he would never have anything to do with the sale of narcotics. That was a lie. Bulger became interested in burnishing his own public image, and eventually he did start to develop a public profile. He was written about in the Boston Globe as this gangster who was the brother of this powerful politician. And it started to take shape as a really powerful myth in the city of Boston, just the idea of the gangster and the politician, the two brothers. And there was a certain aspect of Whitey being seen as some sort of Robin Hood in the neighborhood. And some people stood by that reputation of Bulger until it was completely unmasked and revealed to be a carefully orchestrated lie.
Did he and his brother, it was his younger brother who became the politician, were they friendly? Did they get along?
They were friendly. They had a older brother, younger brother relationship. They were never seen together in public ever. And if Billy Bulger was ever questioned about his criminal brother and whether there were any connections there, Billy Bulger would accuse the Inquirer of anti-Irish sentiment and that he was being tarnished unfairly with the reputation of his brother. He didn't disown his brother in any way, but mm-hmm. he certainly would not accept any guilt by association in any way. And Bill Bulger was too smart, you know, to be directly involved in any criminal activity. But they enhanced each other's reputations in ways that gave them power within their separate worlds. I mean, an associate that I interviewed of Whitey Bulger's, Pat Nee, who was an interesting character who had been a rival of Bulger's and then became a partner. You know, I asked him, why didn't you whack Whitey? At certain points, Bulger was killing associates of Pat Nee's. And I said, you know, why didn't you go after him? He said, we couldn't go after him because of Billy Bulger. If we killed the brother of the most powerful politician in the state, we would have brought down a level of heat from law enforcement that would have put us out of business. So they enhanced and protected each other in ways. I mean, Billy Bulger's reputation literally kept Whitey Bulger alive.
So Whitey Bulger flees Boston in 1995. What precipitated that?
Well, he'd been tipped off by John Connolly that he was about to be arrested and be indicted. And the story goes is that Whitey had sort of anticipated that this day might come, and that while he was still a criminal, he had traveled a lot around the world. And the theory was that he had deposited money in various bank accounts at different locations around the world, knowing that he would go on the lam at some point. And he did go on the run. And, you know, I don't think the FBI was very interested in finding him. They initially assigned the task of apprehending him to the very same organized crime unit that he had the corrupt relationship with. And I know they weren't interested in finding him. So those first few years he was on the run, which are crucial years in terms of finding a fresh information that might lead you to his whereabouts.
Right.
They just weren't really looking for him. So, but that changed over time. Agents retired, new agents came in, and eventually the U.S. Marshals Service was brought in on the hunt for Whitey Bulger. And it was really the Marshals Service that changed the strategy, focused on Whitey's girlfriend. She was known to have sort of a beauty routine, and they started to send out information to various beauty parlors. And that was, in fact, exactly what led them to Bulger, and they apprehended him in Santa Monica in 2011.
They found hidden in the wall of his apartment, I guess, almost $1 million in cash. How much money do they suspect he had stashed outside of Boston?
Well, it would be in the many millions. You know, it's hard to put a number on what his illegal proceeds might have been over the years. Certainly more than $1 million. I mean, they were involved in some major criminal rackets that netted them, you know, millions of dollars. Their cocaine operation alone brought in, it was estimated, about $5 million a month on a monthly basis. So, you know, we're talking about a guy who may have had as much as $30 or $40 million in cash. You know, the government was very interested on trying to find out where that money is, and Bulger hasn't said anything about it, keeps his mouth shut about it. A lot of people believe that he stashed that money and that he would try to get it to his nieces and nephews, the children of William Bulger, who I'm sure that the authorities might be keeping an eye on for years to come, and in the eventuality that they would take a trip to Switzerland or somewhere in Europe and try to retrieve this cash, you know, in a bank account somewhere.
I love reading your kind of blow-by-blow of the trial that ensued. First of all, it didn't start for 2 years, you said, because the defense attorneys needed that much time to acquaint themselves with what he did.
Yeah. Oh, this is such a vast story. I mean, Bulger was allowed to function as a criminal informant for such a long period of time, and so many criminal acts took place during this period. And then, of course, he goes on the run for 16 years, and that extends this story well into the new century. And here we are, you know, in 2015, still talking about Whitey Bulger,
mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a story that has spanned close to half a century, and there's so many murders that took place, and each murder is its own, is kind of a, could have been a criminal investigation unto itself. Very complicated, hard to take it all in. The criminal defense attorneys, of course, were coming into it kind of late in the game and having to catch up on the Bulger lore.
By the way, taxpayer paid.
Yes, taxpayer paid. The trial was fascinating to me and was the thing that motivated me to write the book, because I began to get a sense that the trial was sort of a continuation of the cover-up on the part of the government that I've been talking about all along, and I see as the original sin and sort of the central thread that runs through this conspiracy that existed between the government and Whitey Bulger. And the trial, the prosecutors were determined that historical context would not be part of this trial,
mm-hmm.
that the focus would be so limited to Bulger and the crimes that he committed. And they were very rigorous about making sure that it didn't spill over into areas that would be damaging to the reputation of the criminal justice system.
But wasn't it damaged nonetheless?
It was, could have been a lot worse.
Yeah.
I mean, anytime Joe Barbosa's name was mentioned, for instance, the prosecution would object on the grounds of relevance beyond the scope of the trial, and the judge would reaffirm that objection. And so the trial never was the full accounting of the whole Bulger story that a lot of us hoped that it would be, because it was sort of the final opportunity, really, to have a full airing of what happened here and to get at the question of how did this happen? How did Whitey Bulger get into this position of power for such a long period of time? And the trial was inadequate in that sense. It didn't really fulfill that function. But in a way, for me as a writer, it was advantageous because, I was writing about the trial, but a large part of the book is filling in the blanks, all the parts of this story that were deliberately kept out of the trial.
And the judge, not necessarily a critique of the judge, is it?
Well, I think the judge was part and parcel to the system's need to protect itself.
Hmm.
I mean, the final line I use in this book is in the end, the system protects itself. And that's part of what the Bulger trial was about. Prosecuting Whitey was the easy part. They had a ton of evidence to bury him for many decades. And that was a foregone conclusion. The difficult part for them was to contain the narrative so that it didn't spill over into these areas that would be detrimental to the image and reputation of the government. And yeah, I think in a way that the judge was a party to that. I mean, there was lots of legal basis for them to make the argument mm-hmm. that information didn't belong in the Whitey Bulger trial. And there were legal grounds for that. But I think they could have allowed it to go in that area if they had wanted to, and they most definitely did not want to.
And we're just about out of time, but he refused to be called an informant, too.
Yeah. He was an informant. He was what is known on the street as a rat, but he doesn't want to accept that because it doesn't fit his image of who he is. And probably when he forged his relationship with Connolly, he said, look, I'm not a rat. I'm not an informant. If you ever say that I am, I'll deny it. And then he proceeded to give them information that they used to take down rivals of his. So he was functioning as an informant and as a rat. He just doesn't want to admit that to himself.
Okay, well, TJ English, lots more to learn about Whitey Bulger and your book. Thank you so much for joining us today to talk about it.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity.
TJ English, he's the author of Where the Bodies Were Buried, Whitey Bulger and the World That Made Him. Thanks to the Allside staff, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, assistant producer Shyla Knott, and the interns Trent Lammers, Ryan McFadden, and Sydney Schaefer, with video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DiCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.